Hi, and we'd like to welcome Elizabeth Lundbeck to New Books in Psychoanalysis today to speak with us about her most recent and fascinating publication, The Americanization of Narcissism. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Tracy.
Yeah, I wanted to begin, I guess, the New Books Network, we ask a question of almost all of our authors to start off the interview. And I wanted to ask you to talk to us about, you know, how it was you came to decide to write about narcissism's Americanization, or this book.
Okay. Well, this has roots long in my past. When I finished my first book, I realized that there was a leftover question which had to do with the personality disorders. Mm-hmm. I've really been interested in the personality disorders for about 20 years, and kind of their uneasy fit in the psychiatric sort of epistemology, and I think the uneasy fit continues, like trait versus state, character versus symptom. And my first job was actually at the University of Rochester. I was hired by Christopher Lash. Very interested in his book. I think it's a brilliant book. I think it's a product of its time. I think it has a lot to tell us about the time. And I also think it's very problematic in the legacy it's left to us in thinking about narcissism. So for about 20 years, I've been thinking off and on about narcissism and got serious about it about 6 years ago and decided I had to write this book finally.
So you went and studied, you were a colleague of Christopher Lash. I guess that leads us to the next question. So largely the listenership here is psychoanalysts, psychoanalytic fellow travelers, patients, etc., people who may or may not know about Christopher Lash. Could you explain to the listening audience the central role played in the making of your overall argument in this book by the writing and thinking of Christopher Lash?
Sure. So Lash, brilliant polemicist, a historian at the University of Rochester, published a book in 1978, The Culture of Narcissism, which made an immediate splash in learned and popular circles. He was actually featured in People magazine, invited to the White House. Everybody knew about the book. Narcissism became the topic of the day. The role the book plays is that I call the book The Americanization of Narcissism because narcissism before the 1970s really didn't have a sociology. It was a term that was used by psychoanalysts who had been puzzling over it, worrying over it since 1914. Right. But in terms of the wider publication, there was not much talk of narcissism. And you can look at this by doing a Google Ngram or looking at New York Times. You see a spike in the in the 60s, but really spikes up in the 70s.
Something is happening. Hold on. Something fell out of my microphone.
Did you lose all that?
Hold on. No, it seemed to be recording. I think that we're fine. We'll keep going.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's very strange. You were recording and I was being quiet and I think we're okay. This is New Books in Psychoanalysis and we sometimes have technical errors. Okay. Back to you, Elizabeth.
So I was talking about how Lash's book kind of gave narcissism a sociology. So published in 1978, and as your analyst audience will know, the 70s was the time of a revolution within psychoanalysis, largely around Cohut, but also around Kernberg, when narcissism became like the focus of intense debate and controversy. My feeling is, and my book is really argued around this, is that the analysts and the cultural critics, not only Lash but others, were arguing basically around the same set of sort of antipathies: poverty versus plenty, gratification versus renunciation, and so on. And my argument is that that's in some ways why Lash's book was so readily accepted, is that we were used to these antipathies and antinomies, whatever. But I also think that Lash's book had an unfortunate consequence for narcissism's sort of public fate reception that continues to this day, and that is that it entered the public discussion tied to a critique of consumption.
Right.
So that narcissism in popular culture was tied to excess and gratification, whereas within psychoanalysis, it was largely tied to renunciation, because the narcissist is the person without needs. The narcissist needs nothing. The narcissist of popular culture needs everything. So there was a kind of inversion, a twist in translating psychoanalysis for the public. And I think this continues to this day.
This is a non-psychoanalytic question, but I also have a background as a historian. I couldn't help but, as I was reading this book, to think about the work by the sort of the consumer critics, the historians like T.J. Jackson Lears, Jean-Christophe Agnew, David Nassau, who I studied with, and thinking about this work as also perhaps in conversation with some of that work as well. Is that how you see it situated? Or
oh, absolutely. I think that the late 70s, early 80s was the time when the historians' critique of consumption kind of reached its high point. consumption was all bad. Interestingly, John Agnew, I think, has kind of changed his tune somewhat. I think he's among the most brilliant of that whole group of cultural critics. Historians began, actually people were consuming in the 18th century. There was a revolution then. Actually, they were consuming earlier. It wasn't just that at the turn of the century we moved from production to consumption, but it's been a long process. But so social critics criticize. And Lash and Reif and other social critics, that was what they were doing.
The book takes us from Freud's famous essay, which you've mentioned, on narcissism, and leads us through myriad manifestations and understandings of the very same term, bringing us through the mid-decade, which you're referring to now, and beyond. Can you explain for the listening audience your take on Freud's thinking regarding narcissism, given that that's part of your launching pad? Yeah.
So Freud's take on narcissism was, first of all, covered a lot of ground. I think there's basically 90% has to do with the essay on narcissism. 10% is the kind of narcissistic figure from the Libidinal Types essay, 1931, who kind of strides across the world stage, is a font of creativity, but also has a great capacity for destructiveness. That is the narcissist in the management literature today.
Right.
So it's a brilliant, very short character sketch by Freud. Freud also has throughout his writings kind of little bits here and there where he refers to the narcissist's self-sufficiency. So that too has been incredibly influential. That said, one of the main thrusts of the essay has to do with the kind of sovereign self. I would argue the Freudian sovereign self, the self without needs, his majesty, the baby, the child who needs nothing, and so on. And that is in the Freud of 1914. Interestingly, due to practices of translation, the German word that was translated elsewhere in the standard edition as self-esteem is rendered in On Narcissism as self-regard, which has led to an incredible amount of confusion.
Wow. I wonder how in the Phillips Penguin edition
I looked it up. It's not translated as self-esteem. But elsewhere in the Strachey's translated the word substitute as self-esteem elsewhere in the same edition. And Erickson, who was reading Freud in the German and was is very familiar with Viennese German, obviously. Also talked a lot about self-esteem and located that in on narcissism. So there's any number of controversies. Did Freud, was he talking about self-esteem or not? Well, yes, he was. I mean, translation is not 100% word to word, but it's, I think it's an interesting choice that self-regard has a very different feel to it than self-feeling. Mm-hmm. At the end of the essay, Freud does talk about self-esteem and our need to regulate our self-esteem. I think that has been an incredibly rich vein for analysts since then. So self-esteem is not a product of the me decade. Mm-hmm. Self-esteem actually is in Freud. It's in the 1930s Viennese. It's something that we all must sort of have, regulate, monitor, manage, and so on.
Interesting. I was thinking in your writing about your understanding of Freud's essay on narcissism, his thinking on narcissism, I was looking for the stone wall the stone wall of narcissism, obviously the cultural critics are not going to write about the psychotic patient. Mm-hmm. However, that I think that that patient or that person is also part and parcel of is in that that essay. And my sense of that essay is also Freud's telling us, I don't like to treat these people.
Right. So I have a chapter on the book called Inaccessibility, and it's really about, well, and also another chapter on gratification. Yep. That really kind of rephrases the whole analyzability question. Mm-hmm. Because for at least, I don't know, 60, 70 years, there's been talk of this so-called new patient, a psychoanalyst, the patient who suffers from, or the widening scope patient, the patient who suffers from something other than hysteria or obsessional neurosis, the foundational psychoanalytic complaints. And there's been debate, it's in Balint, it's in other writers from the 1930s, about whether or not patients of this sort are amenable to psychoanalytic treatment. Mm-hmm. By the 1950s, at least in America, the criteria for analyzability were so strict and demanding that there was the concept kind of folded from within as much as it was attacked from without. And from without, it was attacked by Coe, it was attacked by others who said, wait a minute, we can treat these patients with so-called narcissistic transferences with psychoanalytic methods. Mm-hmm. You see it in the British object relations theorist Winnicott. You see it in, like I said, in Balint and others, the mainstream in America, at least, was ego psychology. The patient basically has to have good object relations, an intact ego and everything right before he or she begins analysis.
Right. The patient that doesn't need quite as much help. It leads us back to the question of gratification and the transformation of analytic technique. But in the book, I want to lay it out for the listeners and potential readers. You do introduce the readership to two distinct psychoanalytic thinkers, and they are primarily, although others are certainly part and parcel of this text, but the two main heavy hitters, they each get their own chapter. One is Kernberg and one is Kohut. Could you talk to us about their differing understandings of narcissism, just to lay it out so people get a feel for these two thinkers? And then I want to ask you, why don't you do that? And then I have a question.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, to put it very schematically and simply, and I think it does capture a real difference. I think of Coet as the kind of prophet of healthy narcissism, right, and Kernberg as the theorist of pathological or malignant narcissism. Mm-hmm. So healthy narcissism, which got dropped completely from the popular conversation because it didn't fit with what the critics, their critique. The idea that you need a little bit of narcissism, some quantity of narcissism to actually exist and to do anything creative, worthwhile, make an impact on the world. Mm-hmm. That's associated with Kohut. Kernberg, brilliantly sketches the malignant narcissist, yeah. Starting in the 70s. And this was picked up by Lash especially, because it fit with the kind of cultural, the preoccupations of the critics. But as I argue in the book, Kernberg was not going to buy the critics' argument. He was much more nuanced and wrote a fair amount about, or continues to write about, normal narcissism. And so in some ways, Kernberg and Coa agree. But at the time, if you look at the literature, analysts were fighting tooth and nail over Kernberg versus Coa.
Oh, yeah.
Which was actually good for psychoanalysis, I think, because controversy is good.
Right.
And what my sense is that, and this is what I argue in the book, is that narcissism was the vehicle through which psychoanalysis kind of transformed itself, broke its allegiance to ego psychology, and led to the kind of pluralistic analytic scene we have today in America.
Right. No, that's quite true. In reading about, the sort of primacy of Kohut and Kernberg in the book, I began to think about other analysts, right, who were writing, I think, at the same time, more or less, like Sheldon Bach or Herbert Rosenfeld, even a Hyman Spotnitz, and they didn't really catch the attention of the culture critics. How in the world, I mean, given how unlikely it is today that we would have a culture critic utilizing psychoanalytic thinking, how is it that a Lash or a Reif, got to Kernberg or Kohut in the first place? I mean, how would they, did you have a sense of that?
Right. Well, I think it's important to point out that psychoanalysis was part of learned conversation, the learned worldview in a way that is not today, except maybe within the academy, and even not that very much anymore. From the 50s, 60s, 70s, critics were right. The major cultural critics were steeped in analytic thinking. David Riesling, for example, the author of The Lonely Crowd, the best-selling work of sociology in the 20th century, at least in American sociology, had been in analysis, was in dialogue with Eric Fromm. His book is very analytic in conception. Analysts and cultural critics were in conversation with each other. Alan Wheelis, who wrote The Quest for Identity in 1958, relied a lot on The Lonely Crowd for his kind of take on what was wrong with the current American scene. So that's the first thing to say, that psychoanalysis had a kind of ambient presence that it no longer has as much. I would argue it's still present. It's just not always marked as psychoanalysis. That said, I think a lot of this had to do with Kohut, who I think was a brilliant politician. He was the most Freudian of the Freudians until he wasn't. And what he managed to do was to take on the Freudian establishment and not get banished from the analytic fold as every other major thinker who had taken on the establishment had been.
Was he he was president of the APA before?
Yes.
While he was allied with ego psychology, or did he manage that after?
I'm pretty sure it was while he was still aligned with ego psychology.
That would make sense, but I was wondering if he was that master.
I don't remember the exact year. His early article on observation, which caused quite an uproar, was 1959. So I think it was in the 60s, but I'm not sure. I don't.
Interesting. There was. I read the book in a reading group. Actually, it came about at the end of a course that we were taking on a technique class. A bunch of us were, just sitting around and talking. We thought, wow, we have time in our schedules that we never normally have carved out. Let's read a book together this summer. And so your book, it seemed it would be a refreshing, sort of a reprieve from technique, a reprieve from theory. It was a chance to just, soak up the mind of a historian at work. So out of that reading group, there were some interesting observations. There are people who are largely analysts or interested in psychoanalysis in the old 1950s sense. They're like Marxists who like psychoanalysis.
Right.
Yes, they still exist.
Right.
So, all right. So one question that the group had is that there was a little bit of a confusion as to what made narcissism, was the argument in the book that narcissism was particularly American or is it really, can we understand narcissism as a product of modernity and late capitalism? I mean, is it a, would you, is the book saying that there's something unique? How about this? Is there a relationship between narcissism and American exceptionalism, to ask an old historical question?
Okay, I see. I understand the question. I'm actually not arguing that narcissism is particularly American, although many people would say that. The Americanization refers to the conceptual apparatus through which we understand the American character, which then is cast as particularly narcissistic. Are Americans more narcissistic than others? That's such a sort of
an American
broad stroke question that it's not the most interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting question, but that's not the question that I set out to answer. I'm just interested in tracking how it came to kind of take over cultural criticism and why it had such purchase.
Right.
And it happened first in America. So some Brits reading Lash are like, you know, why do Americans criticize themselves so much? Why do they like, you know, why are they so self-flagellating? One of the reasons I think it took off in America first, well, first of all, Cohen and Kernberg were here, but that's not, I mean, there's an, you know, transatlantic analytic conversation at that time. The cultural criticism post-World War II cultural criticism in America was quite different than post-war cultural criticism, say, in England. In America, a lot of the problem was about excessive individualism or not enough individualism, depending on who you take, but also a lot of critique of affluence.
Right.
In Britain, people were poor. There was no critique of affluence, and the signal works of sociology were about the community. Young and Wilmot work on the slums, for example. It was not about the sort of glad-handing, sort of salesman, the slippery, almost psychopathic salesman figure that you get out of Reisman. So I think that I'm interested in how sort of the cultural surrounding intellectual tools shaped our understanding, but as to whether Americans were more narcissistic than others, probably, but it's a kind of a question that, you know, all we have is the categories that we have. We don't have what people actually were.
Right.
Like, we can't go back and re-diagnose people.
Right. This group that I read the book with, we were drawn to it also because of the pleasure of reading a book that tells us about a moment in which psychoanalytic thinking was taken seriously, as something to be a way to think about problems in the culture, even if, you know, we can understand that maybe the way in which Lash utilized those ideas was flawed. Today we have maybe a Zizek or a Butler who, you know, are kind of doing that work, but their work is less accessible than the work of Lash. We just disconnected. Oh dear.
I lost you.
Uh-oh. Okay. Hold on one second. No, we're still recording. It's great. You're still there? Yes.
Yeah, I heard Butler and then I didn't hear anymore.
Yeah, something. It just, okay, but we're still recording. That's great. All right. The technology is helpful in this regard. Anyway, I wanted to ask you a question since you were engaging, you know, with the, you know, this topic, the way in which a psychoanalytic idea could be utilized and put forth in the culture. In what way could you imagine today the psychoanalytic thinking being put to use outside of the clinic contemporarily, or how could you see it being deployed if you could imagine it?
Oh, I think it is being deployed outside of the clinical setting. Around narcissism, especially in the management literature, there are hundreds and hundreds of research papers on the narcissistic leader. Is narcissism a plus? Is it a minus? How are we going to titrate the right amount of narcissism? This has been going on within the management literature since the 60s and 70s. And interestingly, Kernberg has written a lot about groups.
Right.
Was very much part of that conversation. I would say in the last 10 to 15 years, it's really entered the public kind of conversation. If you go to a kind of airport bookstore, which always has a big section for traveling executives, there's always stuff on, you know, how to be a leader and so on. And basically the consensus now is that, well, we know leaders are going to be narcissistic. We just have to make sure they're not too narcissistic. That is, kind of get the right amount of narcissism in our leaders. So I think that psychoanalysis is very much alive in that sort of part of our culture. Michael McAbee, a psychoanalyst who worked with Fromm, published a book in, I think, 2002, or maybe that was his article, on the productive narcissist, making an argument for the virtues of narcissism as long as it's kept sort of in some kind of reined in some sort of way. Mm-hmm. I would say it's interesting that the New Yorker, every 2 weeks or 3 weeks, there's a sort of the stock, you know, analytic cartoon.
Yes.
And I don't think it's just in New York that the couch and the analyst signifies something. I think in advertising and sort of development of products and so on, there's a huge amount of analytic thinking going on. It's just not named psychoanalysis. So I think there are places in the culture. I think the sort of Fairburnian model of the frustrating object and how difficult it is to separate from that. There's a wonderful book by David Solani on called The Illusion of Love, which is about why abused women can't leave their abusers. It's a very powerful argument, much more powerful than, and he argues this as well, than learned helplessness. So I think there's room, you know, for public policy thinking that is somewhat psychoanalytic. And it's going on. It's just, as I said earlier, it's often not named as psychoanalysis. So I'm not as down on psychoanalysis as psychoanalysis's fortunes as some are. I think analysts don't, in general, do a very good job of kind of thinking broadly about their publics. We can do a better job of that, but I do think there is room for, you know, very sophisticated analytic thinking.
But it seems to be
can't hear you.
You can't hear me.
Now I can.
You can hear me. Okay, great. It seems to be in the examples you cited, really in the private sector highly. I mean, it's, you know, you said it's
right,
you know, on like Wall Street and advertising. And I was thinking, wow, that's you're right. I mean, I do see that literature. It is out there. But it's not named as psychoanalytic, but where, you know, it's hard to see where else it is. And it's interesting that it's made such an impact in those spheres.
I mean, corporations are hiring psychoanalysts to coach their chief executives, paying a huge amount of money for these people. So, right. I mean, corporations don't waste money too willingly. Mm-hmm. Someone's seeing some value in this. Boards are seeing value in this. Right. But it is in the private sector that this is going on. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I certainly know analysts who are working at with hedge funds, et cetera. It's pretty, it's interesting work, and it certainly pays the bills much.
right.
It really pays the bills. In the book, the book itself is divided up into two sections. And the first section, for the readership and listenership to know, it will help the lay analytic reader to become familiarized with the work of Kohut and Kernberg. I found the second half of the book, perhaps because I'm a clinician and I know Kernberg and Kohut pretty well. I found the second half, completely fascinating, where you parse the dimensions of the discourse on narcissism into six domains, right? Right. I mean, your work as a historian absolutely takes flight as you take us on a conceptual tour. But I wanted to ask you to elucidate, as you can for the listeners, how these six categories, and I'll name them, we have self-love, these are each chapters in the book, independence, vanity, gratification, inaccessibility, and identity. Why these six? I mean, how do these six relate to something that's peculiarly American in the realm of narcissism, if that's an appropriate question?
Okay, that's a great question. I will say it took me a long time to figure out how to write this book. Mm-hmm. It is impossible to write a linear history of the development of the concept,
right?
I would argue. Michael Stone, in putting together his Essential Papers volume on the borderline concept, basically throws up its hands somewhere in the 60s or 70s, and it branches everywhere. And the same thing is true in narcissism. You start with Freud and Ferenczi and then branches out. So you cannot tell a coherent unfolding towards the present type of story. So I decided to break down dimensions of narcissism. To my mind, were very important dimensions. So I also introduced them in semi-historical order. So the first would be self-love. And this starts with Freud's essay on Leonardo from 1910, in which narcissism is cast as love of self. So Leonardo, the artist, is narcissistic because he puts himself in the place of his mother and loves a young boy in the way that his mother had once loved him. So this, to Freud, signals an incapacity for object relations because it's sameness. The homosexual relationship is not cast as between two people. It is an internal relation to oneself. Narcissism is, in 1910, an arrested development, an arrested stage in development when one should move from self-love to love of the other. So what the chapter kind of traces is the way that this is turned upside down. Mm-hmm. So self-love in 1910 is an impediment to object love. By the 1970s, enabled by Coet, but also enabled by others, self-love is the foundation for object love. And this is captured in the cultural saying that you have to love yourself before you can love anybody else. So self-love becomes self-esteem, and self-esteem, before it's demonized, is seen as necessary to make oneself a sort of participant in civilized social life. Mm-hmm. The second chapter on independence takes its start from Freud's 1914 essay, in which he argues for independence as a kind of value beyond question. And it's not just Freud who argues for this, but his followers really work hard to stress, point out at every turn Freud's independence. Dependency is seen as a weakness, particularly associated with women.
It's a reaction formation for sure.
Right. So like self-love, independence is dethroned by the 60s and 70s, and dependency is seen as the mark of maturity, the ability to admit to needing others, not being this kind of sovereign Freudian self. And so the narcissist, the one who needs nothing, needs no one, is seen as the problematic character, not the dependent individual. Vanity, it was kind of inescapable because it's so much part of the conversation now about narcissism, and especially the way that the term was feminized in cultural work from Lash's time through to our own. And in this, I recaptured what I thought was a fascinating early 20th century conversation in which pleasure and delight in the body was sort of running, was just at the center of a wide-ranging conversation among psychoanalysts and psychologists. Mm-hmm. There was as well an attempt to kind of question the assumption that women were more vain because they didn't have a penis, and therefore clothing was an attempt to make up for that. So it's a very rich conversation. I would say much richer than the conversation today, in which vanity is really proscribed. It is especially for psychologists, research psychologists, feeling good about oneself is a sign of narcissism. Well, Koha and Kernberg come along and say, wait a minute, feeling good about oneself is necessary to life. Mm-hmm. Gratification traces a longstanding argument divide within psychoanalysis between a Freudian view and a Ferencian view. It retells the story of the Freud-Ferenczi break and the consequences that that had for psychoanalysis, the prescription of gratification and the kind of hollowing out of the analytic relationship and the kind of intense asceticism of the analytic setting. By the 50s and 60s, analysts are proposing sort of ancillary modes of relationship to supplement the transference, because the transference has become so impossibly austere. Mm-hmm. Gratification by the 1960s and 70s, again, is turned inside out.
Don't you quote, if I recall, the Janet Malcolm what's his name? It's
Aaron Green.
Yes, thank you. I'm like Kurt Eisler, Aaron Green, whoever we imagine it was. With the impact of Kohut on his thinking, it's really
It's interesting because a number of analysts I've talked to have said, don't much like Kohut's theorizing, but I really learned a lot from him about what it is to be an analyst. And I think one of the most interesting of these is Tony Crist, who writes about this a lot. It's like, how did we forget? Why did we need Kohut to remind us that we're dealing with someone who's in pain? But we did need Kohut to do that. And, Tony Crist is by no means a Kohutian, but he really was quite sort of brave to, given the reigning eco-psychological environment, to get out in front and say, we've got to pay attention to this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Should I go to the next chapter?
I wanted to comment on something just so the listeners know, that while Elizabeth is taking us through these chapters, which are really incredible, incredible reads, I would argue that they read as even just on their own perfectly well. You could pull one out, and I imagine that we could put the vanity chapter in any gender studies course and, of a particular ilk, and it would really would be, a terrific read. I also thought that the chapter on self-love really belongs in any queer studies class, thinking about, how did homosexuality and narcissism come to be conflated? Because you really make mincemeat out of that idea. And I know it's been made mincemeat out of before, but it maybe, there's still an ascendant idea that there is an inherent relationship between homosexuality and narcissism. It's a hard one, to shake even within psychoanalysis today, for sure. And
right.
And I think that you as a historian, coming at it as a historian, and I believe you also are you've trained as a as an analyst? Is that yes?
I'm training. Yes.
You're training. Oh, okay. I graduated, and best of luck to you. Okay. But yep. But I think that there's something about the way in which you go about making the mincemeat that you make in that chapter, and really separating out so well the difference between love of sameness, love of self, narcissism. You just keep unpacking and unpacking, and when you move to the next chapter in independence, and we see how much Freud was so dependent and so needed to be mirrored himself. He needed a mirror held up to him so frequently, and when he didn't have it, he fell apart. Those two chapters, if you can't read the whole book, and you know about some psychoanalytic theory of Kernberg and Kohut, go to those two chapters, and I thought they were a feast. I just wanted to say that to you. I mean, they were truly a feast.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. If you want to go, let's see, we go. I want to ask you.
Sure.
Okay. Joan Riviere, you really give her props. I haven't, I love her too. I mean, and she is sort of an underground, we love her, and she's
right.
Womanliness as Masquerade is just such a touchstone of a piece. As I read what you were writing, you write a lot about her sort of biographically. I learned a lot about her that I didn't know. And I had the fantasy that perhaps you could be her biographer. Any interest?
I actually thought of it for a while and then decided, well, I'll do this book instead. I think she's a fascinating character and has really been undervalued in the history of psychoanalysis. Judy Butler found her and I think is the foundation for her being a kind of feminist fetish object. There's thousands of references to Riviere and performativity.
Right.
And she's a brilliant theorist. She's very conventional in some ways about womanhood. But what I liked about her was that she made the argument for the pleasures of narcissism, that is the pleasures of self-sufficiency, but she made it from a position of womanhood, not from a position of sort of male sovereignty. So in a way it's very essentialist, but it's a very powerful argument. She is in treatment first with Ernest Jones and then with Freud. Both of them consider her a narcissist. She herself considers herself a narcissist, although she doesn't like that so much. But she writes brilliantly about what it feels like to be a narcissist. So I argue she's kind of the first phenomenologist of narcissism. And she writes beautifully. So she's a pleasure to read. She didn't write a lot, but everything she has written is a beautiful read. And her 1936 article on negative therapeutic reaction, basically about, again, the analyzability question, is a brilliant article. And it's cited by Kernberg, among others.
Yeah, I mean, she really, I think you introduce her to us as taking the difficulties in her own experience as an analysand and developing theory out of that. Although she, looking back on her, I think Freud and who did you say it was? Jones was her.
Yes.
Yeah. She was like a hot potato between them.
Right.
You take her. I don't know what to do with her. I think they had quite a time, but she gave us a tremendous amount to think about. And also her version of women as having something inside of ourselves that like we could be preoccupied with. That's kind of delicious.
I love delicious. Yes.
It's delicious. I'm soaking in it. My own deliciousness. You know what I mean? It's, there is something very beautiful. And
it's such a rebuke to the male theorist. You could only see lack in women.
Right.
And literally lack. And she says in a review essay, I think it's 1934, that, the Freud of 1914 basically looked at woman and was jealous this blissful self-sufficiency. The woman who's like a large beast of prey and a humorist and I forget what the others are. But by 1934, woman is just defined by lack of the penis. And she says, come on. It's much more complicated than that. It might look like lack, but that's because Freud, you're only looking at the surface. You're not being an analyst here.
Right. You have to look, inside, the mysterious continent has to actually be opened up and seen, seen for what it contains within it. I mean, I think that's what she gives us. There's two more chapters, but we don't have a lot of time left. I want to ask you, so another way of, reading this book is, perhaps also on the Americanization of psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
This was something that came up in the reading group as well. I mean, we have two emigres, Kohut and Kernberg. They come to this country. They sink their teeth into the, and they suddenly we find that they sink their teeth into the problems of treating narcissism on the shores of America. I'm wondering, what would you think about reading this book as a way to also look at how psychoanalysis was Americanized?
So I think absolutely. Yeah, that's a large part of what the book is about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll also just throw in Erickson there, who in his work on identity really kind of lays the groundwork for the whole narcissism conversation 20 years later. And he, too, is an emigre psychoanalyst. Had been in treatment with Anna Freud. And he just has such an incredible sort of take on the United States and what's different between America and Europe. And unlike many who come in saying, oh, the Americans are just, sort of lesser versions of these richly imagined European bourgeois Viennese and so on. He says he actually sees a lot of strengths in America, greater gender equality, less overbearing patriarchs and so on. So it's interesting. The conversation is these emigres, and I think that, it gives them a certain license. Although I have to say, ego psychology is also created by the Viennese. So, analysis at this time is largely emigre analysts.
Sure. Sure. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought the sound just might have dropped out. We're having some sound problems, listeners, anyway, but it seems to be recording just fine. There was another question that came up in this reading group that I wanted to pose. We were thinking about, narcissism in America, narcissism as kind of perhaps in a country that blames poverty on the poor, in a country that, where the need to, where when one needs help to survive, one is construed as having had a moral lapse or has an internal defect. We began to wonder if narcissism is a necessary byproduct of a cultural and social order that essentially conveys a message to its citizenry that it's, quote, every man for himself.
Mm-hmm.
If there's but a minimal social safety net available to Americans, are Americans forced to become more narcissistic or defensively grandiose in order to survive? Does America end up with its arch relationship to taking care of the dependency needs of its citizens? Does the country end up fomenting a cadre of potentially thick-skinned narcissists? We can do it by ourselves.
That's a really interesting question, and I think there's probably something to that argument. I'd be interested to look at figures for, say, Britain, which is very close to us in kind of social philosophy, but in some ways quite different. I'm a little skeptical of the kind of broad stroke kind of causative arguments because, at least as they're made by historians, tend to sort of go decade by decade, and you see sort of wild shifts in personality happening in very short amounts of time. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, certainly the culture supports a kind of grandiose self-sufficiency. that is kind of on the manifest level. Behind it, of course, are huge networks of support. That is a kind of American cultural type, the kind of, you know, frontiersman, going out on your own, the self-made man, and so on. So maybe, but is that, what's the relationship between that and kind of pathological, malignant, Kernbergian narcissism? I'm not sure. Just not sure. I'm a little skeptical.
It's a Frankfurt School question, I think.
Yeah. I guess I'm arguing against that kind of one-to-one or whatever you want to call it, relationship between sort of cultural personality and sort of social formation. I think it's more complicated.
Right. I mean, I would agree, but it was an interesting, I mean, I thought it was a fascinating question that came out of spending time reading the book, the question of, you know, what, you know, how much do we have to inculcate narcissism to make up? It's almost, you know, the work on like the wages of whiteness, in which we began to think about narcissism as sort of an invisible wage in the contemporary scene to make up for, you know, what we don't get taken care of that we have to do for ourselves.
Well, I think there's something to it. I'm not the expert on that.
No. But anyway, it's wonderful when, you know, you've written a book that foments and gets people thinking in those terms. So it is 50 minutes, and I do have to go by the time. As much as I'd like to continue talking to you, I have to go. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. I look forward to what you'll write next. You're one of the historians who really does take quite seriously, you know, the work of, you know, in the human sciences, the work of psychiatrists, of psychoanalysts, and we're fortunate to have you. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure, and the questions have been just terrific. So I've really enjoyed it.
I'm glad. Okay. Till next time, this is Tracy Morgan signing off for New Books in Psychoanalysis.